diagnosis. Last April, the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health found that nearly 2,000 homeless people died between April 2020 and March 2021, marking a 56% increase in deaths compared to the previous year before the pandemic began. In Maricopa County, Arizona, the death toll has also risen for people who experienced the homelessness. The more than 700 people who died without permanent shelter in 2022 represented a 42% increase over 2021. Another 450 people could be added to that figure, although local law enforcement has not determined whether those people were homeless. Lisa Glow of Central Arizona Shelter Services told 12 News, "We really are at a crisis. The lack of shelter is leading to those increased street deaths. We've even had babies die in the street. A lot of seniors dying on the streets." The number of deaths of homeless people increased in Denver, Colorado metro area as well, with 263 total recorded last year. However, local agencies state that these figures are incomplete due to the incomplete record keeping. Other cities in Colorado also saw increased numbers of deaths, mostly due to sub-zero conditions, although some were the victims of violent attacks. Many of them were in their 40s. Others died due to opioid use, especially from the use of fentanyl. The U.S. capital, Washington, D.C., recorded 77 homeless deaths in 2021, but this figure does not account for additional autopsies that remain to be completed by the medical examiner's office, which has a 90-day delay in reporting. According to the Washington Post, D.C., appears to be on track to exceed the 100 death mark after recording 180 deaths in 2020 and 138 in 2021. A study conducted by The Guardian and the University of Washington found that from 2016 to 2020, the deaths of people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. rose by 77%, representing at least 18,000 deaths. Regardless of the location of death, a clear fact remains: the life of the average American is seen by the capitalist ruling elite as dispensable, expendable, and holds no value except when it can be exploited for profit. The explosion in the rise of homelessness itself has been caused by a multitude of factors. Millions of Americans have been pushed to the brink of or directly into the path of impoverishment and ruin by the bipartisan attack on living standards and social programs over the past 40 years. Successive bailouts of corporations and banks overseen by both Democratic and Republican administrations, of which the burden of paying for them has been placed on the backs of the working class. The countless sellouts and betrayals by the rotten corporatist union bureaucracies, trillions of dollars spent to build up the military and wage endless wars, which have given way to the US-NATO proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. The ruling class's disregard for human life is most naked in the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, where Trump openly threw caution to the wind in terms of a policy to fight against and contain the spread of the virus. Biden rode in on a wave of popular optimism that he would follow the science if he were elected president. As the last few years have proved, the Biden administration has done nothing but keep this promise, declaring the pandemic over while eliminating public health measures such as enforcing lockdowns, requiring the wearing of masks, social distancing, and quarantining those who are sick or exposed. The consequences have been the official deaths of over 1 million people in the US and over 20 million worldwide, and even such ghastly figures are widely known to be vastly undercounted. The fight for justice is bound up with a fight for access to social rights, which include housing, employment, education, healthcare, and basic necessities. This must be waged as part of a larger fight against militarism, war, capitalism, the source of all inequality and want.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Garner went unconscious.
Cops use of a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
Is death not being called a homicide?
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
You can see the African-American justice facing police in riot gear. These
protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse. Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown. Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like If I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but Black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for Black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen are going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he was actually, he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes?
Let's have him go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story,
yeah.
Really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even
give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
There.
Yeah.
She needs that consistency.
And absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Garner in a chokehold. Garner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Garner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Garner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Garner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said that, just stop breathing. So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., on the first day of the new Congress, Representative Kevin McCarthy fell short repeatedly in his bid to become Speaker, as a right-wing rebellion prompted a historic floor fight. Kevin McCarthy faces a small but determined contingent of hardline conservatives who are intent on denying him the votes to secure the gavel. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story and tells us more. Representative Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, failed three times to secure a majority of votes to succeed Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of San Francisco, as Speaker of the House on Tuesday, 3rd of January 2023, before the chamber adjourned with the outcome of the leadership contest still in doubt. The motion to adjourn was adopted with little opposition on Tuesday afternoon, 3rd of January, following hours of roll call votes that failed to elect a speaker. Kevin McCarthy became the first majority party leader in a century to fail to secure the speakership on the first ballot. He attracted zero additional votes on his second ballot and lost support on the third ballot, as Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, switched his vote from McCarthy to Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio. The reality is that Kevin McCarthy doesn't have the votes, Donalds tweeted after the vote concluded. I committed my support to him publicly and for two votes on the House floor. 218 is the number, and currently no one is there. Our conference needs to recess and huddle and find someone or work out the next steps. Republicans appear to take Donalds' advice as the chamber moved to adjourn until Wednesday afternoon. Kevin McCarthy, however, huddled in the Speaker's office where reporters spotted pizzas being delivered, signaling that it will be a long night for the GOP leader. House Republicans plan to meet in private on Wednesday morning ahead of a fourth round of voting. The repeated failure to elect a speaker is a clear sign of the divisions within the Republican Party. It is also a potential blow to California. If McCarthy prevails, Congress will hand off power and influence from a California Democrat to a California Republican. If he doesn't, both leaders could be relegated to the backbenchers, one by choice, the other by force. 19 Republicans voted for candidates other than Kevin McCarthy under first and second ballots. 20 Republicans voted for Jim Jordan under third ballot, leaving McCarthy 16 short of the 218 votes needed to secure the post he has long sought. Although Tuesday's first-round outcome wasn't a surprise, the fact that McCarthy and his allies were not only unable to move votes his way, but also lost ground in subsequent ballots was shocking, and potentially fatal to his diminishing path to the speakership. A small number of conservative Republicans had for weeks vowed to oppose McCarthy on the floor when the new Congress convened, even as he continued to negotiate with members and make concessions on rule changes. The figure ballooned to 20 by the third roll call. How the weeks-long stalemate between the majority of the House Republican Conference and a growing pocket of conservative antagonists will be resolved remains unclear after three rounds of voting. The House Speaker election hasn't required multiple ballots on a floor vote since 1923, when Representative Frederick Gillett, Republican of Massachusetts, was elected under ninth ballot. According to the House historian, every Speaker election that went more than three rounds lasted at least nine rounds, with one going to 133 ballots in the mid-1800s. NBC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A band of ultra-conservative rebels on Tuesday, 3rd of January, blocked House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy from securing the Speaker's gavel in the first three votes of the new Republican majority, marking the first time the House has gone to multiple ballots to elect a Speaker in 100 years. In a series of dramatic televised votes on the House floor, Kevin McCarthy of California received support from an overwhelming majority of his GOP conference, but that was short of the 218 votes needed to win a simple majority of the 434 House members present. A group of 19 ultra-conservatives opposed him in the first two rounds of voting, but by the third round, that number had grown to 20. The House adjourned for the day just before 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and will return at noon on Wednesday. It's unclear where the Republicans will go from here. Neither McCarthy allies nor his hard-right enemies are backing down. House rules require lawmakers to keep holding votes for Speaker until someone secures 218 votes or a simple majority of members voting. No other House business can occur until a Speaker is selected, which means floor votes, committee hearings, and other congressional work will grind to a halt if Republicans can't agree on a new leader. The last time a Speaker vote went to multiple ballots was back in 1923, when Speaker Frederick Gillett, Republican of Massachusetts, won re-election under ninth ballot. During Tuesday's initial vote, the majority of the conservatives initially backed one of McCarthy's chief antagonists, former Freedom Caucus chairman Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona. But on the second two rounds, the entire group coalesced around Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, even as Jordan called on Republicans to unite behind Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, Democrats unanimously rallied behind the minority leader, Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, in each vote. As is customary, during the first vote of the new Congress, lawmakers stood and cast their vote for Speaker aloud when their name was called. Hakeem Jeffries ended up with more votes than Kevin McCarthy, 212 votes. The House moved to a second round of voting shortly after 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Jordan nominating McCarthy as Speaker. He told his fellow Republicans that their differences pale in comparison to those between Republicans and Democrats. "We better come together," Jim Jordan said, adding, "I think Kevin McCarthy is the right guy to lead us. I really do." Still, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, nominated Jim Jordan for the job. "I'm nominating him and I'm voting for him," Gaetz said. On the third round of voting, which began shortly after 4 p.m., Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, joined conservatives in voting for Jim Jordan. Asked why he changed his vote after previously backing Kevin McCarthy, Byron Donalds said he both believes Jordan will be a tremendous speaker and that there's a reality Republicans are facing. "Kevin doesn't have the votes. This is not a surprise. We knew that Kevin was short of votes. My concern has been like, look, it's been 2 months. You got to close the deal. You had 2 months," Donald said. "And so at this point now, if you can't close it, we got to find someone who can." Donald supported the move to adjourn, saying the party needs to meet and figure out, frankly, who can get 218 votes, and then we go from there. It's an inauspicious start for House Republicans, who recaptured the majority in the November midterm elections, but begin the new Congress bitterly divided and without agreement on who should lead the party. Tuesday's votes cap a week-long standoff between Kevin McCarthy and a small band of far-right members close to former President Donald Trump, who vowed to stick together to deny him the Speaker's gavel. Because the GOP's new 222-212 majority is so thin, McCarthy can only lose 4 votes for the top job. 5 conservatives, the so-called Never Kevins, led by Biggs and Gaetz, said they wouldn't vote for McCarthy under any circumstances and urged him to drop out to allow another candidate to step forward.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
Sometimes in some places, whether in judiciary, the executive branch, or elsewhere, there are some structures that naturally bring corruption. Those structures must be eliminated. Look for these structures, find them, and get rid of them. This is the second point. The third recommendation is about strengthening judicial knowledge. Judicial knowledge needs to be increased. Some of these rulings are either weak or distorted, sometimes by chance. According to a report or something, we have heard of certain rulings like this. If you look at these, some of these rulings are very weak. For example, the 10 arguments that a judge presents for making a decision. At times, most of the arguments that have been presented are flawed and weak. Arguments must be convincing. They must be strong. Even in the prosecutor's office, not just in the courts. The reason presented by the prosecutor must be convincing reasons, and he should be able to defend his reasons. This does not mean that whatever the prosecutor says will automatically be accepted, but his reasons must be logical and defensible.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the case of the judge and the court, this is much more important. This is what I wanted to say about the topic of having enough scientific, judicial knowledge, both with regard to the cases and about decrees. So it is necessary for judicial knowledge to increase. The fourth point is the issue of encouragement and punishment within the judiciary. We've already talked about punitive and corrective measures. They, meaning judges and the staff, should be encouraged too. You see, there truly are some, and we know that they truly struggle. They really work. In some cases, they even take their breaks to look into legal matters. Well, these examples should be identified, and such cases should be encouraged with all kinds of encouragements. When I say encouragement, this does not just mean monetary encouragement. There is encouragement for the person's reputation. There is encouragement by introducing these people and other such encouragements. These people should be encouraged. And this is the next point. The fifth point is that no part of the powers or legal duties of the judiciary, as defined in the Constitution or related laws, should be suspended. No part of them should be suspended.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Majority of U.S. Republicans are against the candidacy of former President Donald Trump in the presidential elections in 2024. Donald Trump is the only president in the history of the United States who has been impeached twice on charges of abuse of power, obstruction of law, and inciting supporters to attack Congress on 6th of January 2021. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered the story and tells us more. Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas says former U.S. President Donald Trump should never be allowed to run for public office again over inciting the deadly violence on 6th of January 2021. Asa Hutchinson, who is considered running for president, reiterated on Sunday, 1st of January, that he preferred a different GOP presidential candidate in 2024, who was not Donald Trump. Hutchinson, a 72-year-old, leaves office in January after serving 8 years as Arkansas's governor. Asa Hutchinson said, "I do not believe that Donald Trump should be the next president of the United States. I think he's had his opportunity there. I think 6th of January really disqualified him for the future." The Arkansas governor said he'd do everything in his power to make sure that there is an alternative Republican nominee for the 2024 presidential race. Asa Hutchinson added, "I want to see everything I can do to make sure there is the alternative and that Donald Trump is not the nominee of the Republican Party. That's the first thing, and let's figure out how to do that." The U.S. House Select Committee lawmakers probing the assault on the Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 concluded in their final report, released on 22nd of December, that Donald Trump was to blame for the deadly incident and also charged him with orchestrating the riot in a failed attempt to cling onto power after losing the 2020 election. The report asserted in its executive summary, the central cause of 6th of January was one man, former President Donald Trump, who many others followed, placing the mob invasion of the Capitol within a multiple-part plan to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The 845-page report, produced after months of witness testimony heard by the bipartisan 9-member panel, said, "President Trump or his inner circle engaged in at least 200 apparent acts of public or private outreach, pressure, or condemnation, targeting either state legislatures or state or local election administrators, or overturned state election results in the 2 months between the election and the Capitol riots." The committee also made a series of 11 recommendations for actions that Congress should take to prevent efforts similar to those to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election from happening again. It also made referrals for the Justice Department to pursue 4 criminal charges against Donald Trump. Trump said the American people have been deceived with lies about the 6th of January 2021 attack from the House Select Committee investigating the incident. He said the House Committee cut the part of his speech at the rally at the Ellipse preceding the unrest out in which he said demonstrators will be walking to the Capitol peacefully and patriotically. But he also said in his speech that people must show strength to take back our country and called on people to fight like hell. The U.S. newspaper The New York Times has also covered the same story. The release of the full report was the culmination of the panel's 18-month inquiry and came 3 days after the committee voted to formally charge Donald Trump with inciting insurrection, conspiracy to defraud the United States, obstruction of an act of Congress, and one other federal crime as it referred him to the Justice Department for potential prosecution. While the referrals do not compel federal prosecutors to take any action, they sent a powerful signal that a select committee of Congress believes the former president had committed crimes. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairwoman of the committee, wrote in the report, "Our institutions are only strong when those who hold office are faithful to our Constitution. Part of the tragedy of 6th of January 2021 is the conduct of those who knew that what happened was profoundly wrong, but nevertheless tried to downplay it, to minimize it, or to defend those responsible." The report contains the committee's legislative recommendations, which are intended to prevent future presidents from attempting a similar plot. The panel has already endorsed overhauling the Electoral Count Act, the law that Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit on 6th of January 2021 in an attempt to cling on to power. Among the committee's recommendations were a possible overhaul of the Insurrection Act and strengthening of the enforcement of the 14th Amendment's ban on insurrections holding office. The panel also said Congress should consider legislation to bolster its subpoena power and increase penalties against those who threaten election workers. And it said bar associations should consider whether any of the lawyers who aided Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the election should be punished. In addition to its focus on Donald Trump's actions, the report went into great detail about the supporting cast of lieutenants who enabled him. Mark Meadows, his final chief of staff, and the lawyers John Eastman, Rudolph Giuliani, Jeffrey Clark, and Kenneth Chesbrough were named as potential co-conspirators in Donald Trump's various attempts to cling on to power. Trump bashed the report on his social media site, Truth Social, calling it highly partisan. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger said in an interview on Sunday, 1st of January, that he believes the Department of Justice will do the right thing and bring criminal charges against Donald Trump for his role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol and on 6th of January 2021. Adam Kinzinger told CNN's State of the Union political talk show on Sunday morning, 1st of January, he said, "I think he will be charged, and I frankly think he should be charged." Adam Kinzinger was one of two Republicans on the Democratically-led January 6 Select Committee, which wrapped up its investigation before the new Congress began its work, when Republicans assumed the majority in the House followed last November's midterm elections. Adam Kinzinger led one of the committee's sessions last June that focused on pressure placed on the Justice Department by Donald Trump or his allies as he strove to persuade them to overturn his 2020 defeat by falsely claiming the election was blighted by widespread fraud. He has represented Illinois in the House of Representatives since 2011 and was speaking following the last sessions held by the committee and on the eve of his departure from Congress. Adam Kinzinger also slammed Republican leaders for maintaining Donald Trump's influence on the U.S.'s political landscape by playing down the significance of the Capitol attack and Donald Trump's incitement of the riot and often backing Trump's lies about elections being rigged or stolen in favor of Democrats. He blamed the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is currently battling to become the new Speaker of the House, as the reason for the former president remaining such a force in U.S. politics. Adam Kinzinger said, "He's the reason Donald Trump is still a factor. He is the reason that some of the crazy elements of the House still exist." Kinzinger said McCarthy had visited Trump at his Mar-a-Lago, Florida residence shortly after the January 6th insurrection. "That show of mutual support at a pivotal moment resurrected Trump's relevance in U.S. politics, strengthening the right." Adam Kinzinger added, "Donald Trump should consider Kevin McCarthy his best friend, because Donald Trump is alive today politically because of Kevin McCarthy." He noted that the then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Senate Republicans failed to convict Donald Trump during his historic second impeachment trial for inciting an insurrection.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.